welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia, and we want to welcome you all to one of our dedication meetings, and this one is ULT, its mission and future. And when we have these types of meetings, we are gathering together not to honor that particular person, that particular form, but we are looking at their dedication, their persistence in following on with these ideas, with this wisdom religion, being a witness on the scene for these types of ideas. So today, if we are looking at the United Lodge of Theosophists as an entity right now, as a vehicle to carry on these ancient ideas, then we can't neglect to look at the person in the form that we know as Robert Crosby. And we will be looking at, we will start the meeting off with a short biography of him as a person in, you know, in that period of time. And then we will have four readings. We understand three of them are by Robert Crosby and one by Madame Blavatsky. And then we will have a longer talk focusing on the mission and future of United Lodge of Theosophists. So Robert Crosby was born January 10th in 1849, and he was born in Montreal, but his parents were Scottish, and they came over to Canada and for work, we understand, something to do with both of them worked for the same company. And while he was in Montreal, he was raised as a Presbyterian, or they tried to raise him as a Presbyterian, because he always felt as though the formal religion with its dictates and its rituals really did not suit him at all. And even as, and in fact, one of the ministers of his church had asked him to take part in a certain type of ritual, and he actually told him, no, I'm not right, I'm not the right person for this to do, for this to be done. And even at the age of 16, he started searching for something else. He knew that the truth was not going to be found in formal religion. And he had thought about going to the heads of the different churches, but then he realized, no, I'm just going to be getting what that particular denomination's idea of the truth is. So he kind of immersed himself then into what we'd look at as a regular mundane kind of a life. But at the same time, he continued to search. He wanted to find the answers to life, death, and suffering. When he was 20 years old, with a partner, they formed a shoe and leather manufacturing company. And he actually ends up marrying his partner's daughter. They were always known as being a very comprehensive and very honest company. His partner's wife died, and he began to, the partner began to look at spiritualism. He wanted to maintain a contact with his wife, so he started going to meetings. Mr. Crosby occasionally went with him, but he always felt as though this was not correct. He always thought that it was a fraud, and this was not where he wanted to go. And he says that he always felt as though that there was something holding him back from getting in, too involved with this sort of practice. Uh, They got one of those in an offers you can't refuse type of deals with their business, and because of that, Mr. Crosby and his partner moved the business to Boston. And his partner was thrilled because there were more spiritualistic activities in Boston than there were in Montreal. And in fact, Mr. Crosby even says in his biography that he got involved somewhat in hypnotism, and that they said that he was very good at doing what he did. But later on, of course, he realizes that hypnotism is not a proper practice. So he did eventually get out of that. In 1887, his partner said to him, look, you know, there's this new kind of meeting forming. It's called Theosophy. Maybe they're having their first meeting. Why don't you come? Well, what intrigued Mr. Crosby at that time too was just the name itself, Theosophy. So he decided to go to this meeting. He went to the first meeting, and from that point on, he knew that he was home. He knew that he had found the place that was going to answer all of his questions. And shortly after he did join, he did become secretary of the Boston group. And we would like to read the meeting that when he first meets Mr. Judge. And we do want to say that around this time, HPB was in India. And although Mr. Crosby never did meet her, we believe there was some correspondence going back and forth between him and HPB. William Q. Judge came to Boston soon after he joined. I was introduced to him together with other members and had no other notice from him until after the meeting when we had parted at the door. He going with some members to his hotel and I in the other direction. We had got some distance apart when I heard him call out, "Good night, Crosby. I've got you on my list." I said good night, but was much exercised at the rest of his remark. Something, however, happened then. A veil was lifted. A tie was formed, which has never since been broken. And from that point on, Mr. Crosby and Mr. Judge remained not only very close friends, but they were also co-workers in the philosophy. March 21st, 1896, Mr. Judge died, and at this point, Mr. Crosby was still in Boston. Catherine Tingley was to take over Mr. Judge's position, and she moved out to Point Loma, California. In 1900, Ms. Tingley asked Mr. Crosby to come out to Point Loma. At that point, they were still doing the startup for the Theosophical Society. So Mr. Crosby moved his family, sold his house, and moved out to California, where he did give over all the money that was made from the sale of his house to the Theosophical Society. So for about 2 years, Mr. Crosby was the witness on the scene. And he was becoming very, not upset, but he was becoming disillusioned at the direction that the Theosophical Society was going. The way that the transition of the duties and the direction of the spiritual focus was not one. He felt as though the way the direction that the Theosophical Society was going at the time was taking away from the lines laid down by the masters and followed by HPB and Mr. Judge. He felt as though things were just going in totally wrong direction. And after much consideration and thinking and talking, he decided that he would have to leave the Theosophical Society. But he never stopped searching. He knew that this was the true way that was put down by the masters. The following years were very difficult for the Crosby family, as the money that he had given to the TS, he never got any of it back to live on, so it was financially, it was very difficult. He became a bookkeeper for the LA Times, and not by coincidence, of course, but because there are no coincidences, he made a lot of his neighbors, he began to contact them and discussing theosophy with them. And on February 18th, 1909, along with seven other associates, Mr. Crosby helped to form the United Lodge of Theosophists. He kept the line unbroken for these ideas, for these studies. He brought back into the philosophy the master's ideals of the three objects and the three fundamentals. And he made the whole point and focus of the philosophy again to be universal brotherhood. No, and this is another quote of his, no formal bond existed among the associates of the ULT, the sole object being the study and dissemination of theosophy, pure and simple. He stressed impersonality and anonymity to protect the work and to help protect the workers from pride and ambition. His dedication to the philosophy was just huge. We will go over his writings, but aside from all the writings and the letters and the correspondence, he never turned anybody away. And he was actually starting to get older, and all of these activities, he really was having a hard time keeping up with. And he died in the 25th of this month, in 1919. He died as he had lived, calm and serene, with no word of complaint during the days of intense suffering that preceded his release. Now, his writings. He did start magazine Theosophy. At the time, it was just called Theosophy. And he pulled together a compilation of Mr. Judge's ideas, uniting them all into one idea. And that's what we have as our declaration that we find in so many of our writings. 1908, he wrote a letter. It was entitled "To All Open-Minded Theosophists." And in it, he says, be theosophists, work for theosophy. And the whole focus, again, was universal brotherhood. 1912, the Theosophy pamphlet, the ULT, its mission and future. And of course, The Friendly Philosopher, which was a compilation of his talks and letters. And the thing that always has struck us about his articles was that he puts in every single article the three fundamentals, and you don't realize that they're the three fundamentals. He doesn't say, this is following the first fundamental, the second. He just was so practical that, and the way he wrote was just so, it was simple, yet deep and complicated at the same time. He edited part of Theosophical Movement, the book, 1875 to 1925. He wrote The Answers to Questions on the Ocean of Theosophy. And we thought this was cute. He wrote an article, Because, for children who ask why, and he put the theosophical themes to music, and he did the music by himself. And of course, he did the last 11 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita notes after he completed them after Mr. Judge died. And a quote from Magazine Theosophy states, HPB was the creator, WQJ was the preserver, and Robert Crosby was the regenerator of Theosophy. And we'll just end with two short quotes of his. Stick to the messengers and the message. Ingratitude is not one of their vices. Go on with the work. We are working in the present for the future. Unless the nature of HPB and WQJ is grasped, Theosophy is not understood and cannot be understood. And then the last one, do not grieve over failures and partial successes. It is the effort that counts. He who, with the right motive and with sincere goodwill, does the best that he can and all that he knows how to do, does enough.
From the writings of H.P. Blavatsky. Theosophy is as old as the world in its teachings and ethics, if not in name. Underlying every ancient popular religion was the same ancient wisdom doctrine, one and identical, professing and practiced by the initiates of every country, who alone were aware of its existence and importance. To attain to its origin and the precise age in which it was matured is now beyond human possibility. A philosophy so profound, a moral code so ennobling, and practical results, it is not the growth of a generation or even a single epoch. Fact must be piled upon fact, deduction upon deduction. Science has begotten science, and myriads of the brightest human intellects have reflected upon the laws of nature. Before this ancient doctrine had taken concept and shape, the wisdom religion is the inheritance of all the nations the world over. The aim of theosophy are several, but the most important of all are those which are likely to lead to the relief of human suffering under any or even every form, moral as well as physical. And we believe the former to be far more important than the latter. Theosophy has to inculcate ethics, it has to purify the soul. If it would be relieved of the physical body, whose ailments save cases of accidents, or all hereditary. It is not by studying occultism for selfish ends that one can ever reach the true goal, that of helping suffering mankind. As mankind is essentially of one and the same essence, and that essence is one infinite, uncreate, and eternal, whether we call it God or nature, nothing, therefore, can affect one nation or one man without affecting all other nations and all other men. This is as certain, as obvious, as that of a stone thrown into a pond will sooner or later set in motion every single drop of water therein. It is an occult law that no man can raise superior to his individual failings without lifting, be it ever so little, the whole body of which he is an integral part. In the same way, no one can sin nor suffer the effects of sin alone. All pain and suffering are the results of the want of harmony, and the one terrible and only cause of the disturbance of harmony is selfishness, in some form or another. Hence, karma gives back to every man the actual consequences of his own actions, without any regard to their moral character. But since he receives his due for all, it is obvious that he will be made to atone for all sufferings which he has caused, just as he will reap in joy and gladness the fruits of all the happiness and harmony he has helped to produce. Make man feel and recognize in their innermost hearts what is their real, their true duty to all men, and every old absurd of power, of unjust law in the national policies based on human, social, or political selfishness will disappear of itself.
Excerpts from the Gita Notes. All of us abort to this study by our own requests made to our higher self, who is Krishna. It does not matter whether he now is consciously aware of having made the request, nor whether it was made as a specific act in this life or many another precedent one. It was made, and it is to be answered at the right time. Some of us have asked many times before, in ancient births of ours, in other bodies, in other lands. Others are making the requests now. But it is more than likely, in the case of those who are spurred on to intense effort and longing to know the truth, and to strive for unity with God, that they have put up the petition ages since. We take up the gauge over and over, life after life, and experience after experience, never completely defeated if we always look to Krishna, our higher self. All the passing shows of life, whether fraught with disaster or full of fame and glory, are teachers. He who neglects them neglects opportunities which seldom the gods repeat. And the only way to learn from them is through the heart's resignation. For when we become in heart completely poor, we at once are the treasurers and dispersers of enormous riches. The attitude to be assumed then is that of doing every act, small or great, trifling or important, because it is before us to do, and as a mere carrying out by us as instruments of the will of that deity who is ourself. This practice is the highest, that which someday we must and will learn to perform. effacement in the Supreme Spirit is gained by the right-seeing sage, whose sins are exhausted, who has cut asunder all doubts, whose senses and organs are under control, and who is devoted to the well-being of all creatures. If the last qualification is absent, then he is not a right-seeing sage and cannot reach union with the Supreme. It must follow that the humblest imitator, everyone who desires to come to that condition, must try to the best of his ability to imitate the sage who has succeeded. And such is the word of the Master. For he says in many places that if we expect to have his help, we must apply ourselves to the work of helping humanity to the extent of our ability. No more than this is demanded. Krishna says that those who with the eye of spiritual wisdom see that the self is all, begin to reincarnate with that belief ingrained in them. Hitherto, they had come back to earth without that single idea, but possessed of many desires and of ideas which separated them from the self. Now, they begin to return fully at rest in the self and working out their long accumulated karma. And at last, they become a Mahatma, or great soul.
From the writings of Robert Crosby, to make ourselves better able to help and teach others is the task. HPB says, the progress of the ego is a series of progressive awakenings. Not being sticks or stones, but human beings, we must feel success or failure. The wisdom is shown in not being swelled up by the one or cast down by the other. We should make a steady, unvarying pursuit of that which is seen to be right. Every working student of theosophy must sooner or later meet some theosophical bumps. These are all good as they come, for if we bump anything, it must be because we are off the straight road, and bumps are of consequence only as indications to us to look to our bearings. We would not feel them if we had not a compass inside. The purpose of life is to learn, and it is all made up of learning. So these things, while they may not make us smile at the time, will be matters to smile at later on. Among the Greeks, it was said that when the earth was starting rolling in space, the gods burst into a fit of laughter, just to see the thing go. So we, being those very gods, can afford to smile at the follies we meet and go on with the work of promulgating correct ideas for those who are able to receive them. We have to cultivate the attitude of mind spoken of in the Bhagavad Gita, of being undisturbed by anything that may come to pass. And these disturbing things are the very means by which we arrive at that attitude. Karma will bring to us what belongs, so there can be no cause for worrying over any future. There is need only that we hold all our powers in readiness to make good use of what is brought to us. And this is best done by a quiet, calm, confident performance of what we are able to do day by day, from day to day. Union and harmony is the secret of strength. So the nearer and closer we get in thought, will, and feeling, the more power will flow from us as a body, till we saturate time and eras, that the men and women of races, ages to come, may prove brethren and lovers as we are. The policy and the methods of ULT were instituted to avoid personalities altogether and make the effort dependent upon a body of students who desire no recognition for nor of themselves, thus putting the teaching directly in the hands of those who would know to be studied and applied. We must and eventually will carry the civilization of the world to a higher stage than has ever before existed. But that will never be until men realize their own nature and act from that basis. If we begin to think aright, we give direction to that spiritual force which is the very essence of our natures. Let a man think aright, let him think and act unselfishly. And just so surely as he does, that he opens up the channels of the brain to a greater and greater perception and realization of his own nature. We must take care of each other, not of ourselves, according to the personal basis on which this and every other nation in the world is proceeding today. We are going to have a league of humanity only when the ancient truths of the wisdom religion are once more perceived, when there is one purpose and one teaching.
From the Friendly Philosopher. In the work which we have undertaken together, it matters not whether we fail or succeed. Our purpose has been and will be that the work shall go on. We can throw each one of us our best into the effort. The rest is in other and stronger hands. It is then to the teachings that attention has to be called, not to ourselves, who are only handing them on as best we can. If one sees that in many ways he is not able to do all that he would like to accomplish, it is evidence that he is in the way of improving. Our ideals are never reached. They continually precede us. As a man thinks, so he becomes. Time is an element in this, and it is shortened by patient doing of what we can. To be in the least cast down by our apparent imperfections is a form of impatience, a disregard of law. One of the greatest helps that theosophy gives is the power to take a wider survey of the field of action than is otherwise possible. We do not look on this life only, but on many future lives during which I and thou and all the princes of the earth will live and strive for the universal redemption of mankind, ever looking ahead, ever seeing further heights toward which the awakening spirit may be directed. Could right philosophy be implanted, even the single idea of the divine nature in man, a greater impetus would be given to right living. Then a philosophy in accord with this nature would be sought by those so quickened. Theosophy, pure and simple, is the standard by which efforts may be applied and errors combated, so it must always be kept in evidence as the source of all right effort. Thank you.
In just a few short weeks, we will witness a majestic event, a cyclic event that is part of the Olympic tradition begun in Athens, Greece. Long before the games begin, before the countries send their representatives, before the opening ceremonies that are so terrific, there is the carrying forth of a lighted torch throughout the host country. And to this day, as was first done in Athens, the flame is lit from the sun's rays and passed from torchbearer to torchbearer until it reaches the site of the games, where it will burn until their conclusion. Its historical purpose, we were astounded to find out, was the spreading of the message of peace, unity, and friendship. And when the torch went around the host country, the signal was there was to be a sacred truce among any warring nations within, that the arms would be put down in respect of this light, this fire coming forward. So today we honor that tradition as well as the one, Robert Crosby, who carried the torch, bearing the light of the original lines of Theosophy forward into a new era. Its message was burning for eons, but has been given out from this platform, known as the United Lodge of Theosophists, as we heard, since 1909, over 100 years now. Robert Crosby, it was mentioned, was the important witness on the scene. And at the time, as in any historical event, such as when a reformer brings a message back to those who need to hear it, there is always a witness on the scene. And in this case, he was to witness the divisions, the schisms that came from, he would say, personalities or claims of successorship. And as he had done earlier in his life, he realized this was not the correct way. This was not the intention of those that came before him, H.P.B. and William Q. Judge. And so at the time when he felt most moved, as was mentioned, a few close friends, associates, who were moved in the right direction, separated themselves from what was going on and began a united front. It's even in the title, the United Lodge of Theosophists. And its sole aim was to present the original teachings. Not original by H.P.B. and Mr. Judge, as we know, but original from the masters, the sages of wisdom, passed down through their emissaries, known as those figures. So the main idea was to keep the lines unbroken, not to have any expansion of the material or reworking of the material, as has been done ever since then in other venues, but to keep that torch burning brightly with the singular pure flame of knowledge that was passed on. And we are sure that Mr. Crosby understood this quote: "Truth is not dependent upon the one who utters it, but upon its own self-evident nature." And he could see this was self-evident truth. Unity then would be the keynote of this attempt. And it said, "The really earnest will judge them by their fruits, not by the persons, because truth verifies itself." The message that each of us, no matter where we find ourselves or what condition we are struggling through, each of us has the ability to learn, to reach that knowledge, that holy wisdom, that flaming torch of truth through our own efforts. This was to be an independent devotion, this United Lodge. The work was to be done by each individual as they were capable and as the quote from the beginning said, given out to the best possible. That was all that was asked. Every individual then was responsible for his own growth, and the main difference between other sources of religion or philosophy was no intermediary was necessary. There was nothing to block one from that knowledge except one's own effort. And so the responsibility was put on each individual as they saw fit. So it also suggested that to look for this wisdom, not only turn within, but look at nature around us and look at our very selves and in the lives we lead and the habits we formed. That this knowledge could be sought through experiment, through thoughtful study, through proving for ourselves that certain laws existed, certain truths were universal. And for the perhaps for the first time in a while, newcomers heard this was possible and lit a flame within them. So we need to experiment and verify for ourselves, just as every presentation of truth, we are told, has been filtered through the minds and hearts of adepts throughout time, one to the other, verifying, testing, before it is ever given forward as truth. But we all know truth has a certain ring to it. There's a certain vibrational experience we get when we hear truth. It's that same movement within when we see that torch pass. We might see it on TV, one hands to another, and there's a vibration to that. There's a very holy or sacred experience there. So what then is our mission? Well, we can look at the three objects of the Theosophical movement, we all know, to form the nucleus of a universal brotherhood of humanity. Huge task, but we already are. It's the conscious recognition that everything is a brotherhood. Without any distinctions, race, creed, color, condition, because we are all one within, from the same source, from the same spirit. The second object, the study of ancient and modern religions, philosophies, and sciences, and the demonstration of the importance of such. We cannot identify truth without seeking out that which is false and setting it aside. So little by little, as Mr. Crosby did as a young man, finding out what didn't suit his mind kept him searching. We will search until we find that which we know to be through our study, truth. The third object being the investigation of the unexplained laws of nature and the psychical powers latent in man. And we know we use those every day. We hear, we see, we recognize, we love, we are sensitive to one another. We are using those powers, but we need to understand how to apply them better, their proper use. In this study, we hear the idea that the power that the disciple shall seek is that he shall appear as nothing in the eyes of men, that he shall step out of the sunlight into the shade, leaving room for others to shine. And that anonymity that was mentioned before was part of the keynote to this movement, that there would not be recognition of a teacher or a leader, rather that what we learned and fully held to be true through our own testing, we would share and step aside. There is no glory, there is no recognition, there are no awards, there is simply the inner work to be done, to be shared, and then to step aside and give the other the chance to let that light shine. So how do we come to these ideas and begin this process? We hear the three fundamental ideas every other Wednesday. And we've heard them in many different expressions because they are universal ideas, but they need to be expressed to our minds and hearts in a way that touches us, that helps us realize that truth, that there is a spiritual font from which we all emanate, that there is a oneness we see in the eyes of each other, that I am I, that we all share, that there is periodicity we prove for ourselves in nature, as was mentioned, that there are cycles, that there are laws by which all universes, all kingdoms, everything in the manifested plane of expression are subject to. And they're simple. Cause and effect. Everything is subject to them. So we are constantly affecting and being affected by everything around us. That implies, necessarily, responsibility. That we are responsible for our own evolution and for that of everything around us as we necessarily or unintentionally influence all of life around us. But it helps us understand we are the dynamic force of spirit in action. There is nothing or no one that needs to explain that to us. We feel it every time we think, every time we speak, every time we love or do something altruistic for another. There's a welling up of joy, and sharing that with another is a way to lift them up. So these fundamental propositions are really the basis of the United Lodge of Theosophists, and we're told their study and their practice and their deep contemplation will over time allow us more of a view, more of a renting of that veil, and a deeper understanding of this ancient knowledge. HPB once wrote, "If anyone holds to Buddha's philosophy, let him say and do as Buddha did and said. If a man calls himself a Christian, let him follow the commandments of Christ." Such a one would be a Theosophist. And so we are fortunate to be celebrating not only the movement, but what we have come to know as the friendly philosopher, Robert Crosby, because he wrote simply and plainly and reminded us that this knowledge is so deep in its essence that it takes lifetimes to firmly grasp, and yet so shallow at its shore that a child can have an understanding of this. And we are both of those, aren't we? And what he did was, through ideas brought up in different talks from Mr. Judge, Mr. Crosby assembled the Declaration, which of course we're all familiar with, but a few reminders. The first thing it tells us is that we profess no attachment to Theosophy, but work independently as soul through self-reliance. That the work we have to do is so enormous that that's what we will concentrate on. You will hear no side issues, no opinions, no expansion of this. Rather, you will hear the straight line ideas that Mr. Crosby so strove to keep sacred. That the basis for union among any of the lodges situated anywhere in the world is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. The teachings we have, the purpose is to make them available to everyone. And the aim is to do that through brotherly contact, which we are all capable of. So we don't need the intermediaries, the bylaws, the officers, the collection plate, none of that is necessary, just the work needs to be done. And that, as was said, to be called a theosophist, we are one who works in the service of humanity. Even if that is just a smile to another having a gloomy day, you have lifted their spirits. We have those words in our vocabulary. We welcome all, because we know at any given time in our lives, we were in different conditions, had different accepted ideas, were searching, were lost, were suffering. These are the welcoming rooms and ideas that give solace, that give comfort, and that invite work and effort. So the true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet to each and all. So the future is sitting in this room, in other rooms, in other lodges around the world right now, rededicating ourselves individually to a common cause, and that is to benefit all of mankind in the natural course of evolution. Mr. Crosby tells us other saviors came to separate and distinct peoples, but the message of theosophy is not to any one nation, to any one class of beings, but to the whole world. The knowledge is obtainable by any self-conscious being for himself, for it is not a question of our ideas, our present perceptions, of morality or success or of external power, but of spiritual perception, of the language of the soul. The language of the soul, we imagine, comes with practice, learning it, exercising it, using it. And two more thoughts from Mr. Crosby. Recognizing that each one of us is from the same source and going towards the same goal, though the path will vary with the pilgrim, we will act toward each other as if he were a part of ourselves. How different would the world be if we did just that? What would it look like? Well, the torch has been passed on to each one of us sitting in this room. How we carry it forward depends on our minds and our hearts, our good intentions and our practical applications of love and compassion. In every moment of altruistic action, we honor those who carried the flame of truth before us and offer the true potential to those we seek to serve. We invite you to spend a few minutes in fellowship considering Robert Crosby and the United Lodge of Theosophists.